a score settling of silencing dissent. He wants to use it to basically intimidate people, and that's why he's getting rid of Radov, because he disagrees with Ray's politics. Christopher Ray is a Republican who Trump appointed. But in this Trump term, he's made it very clear what he wants the FBI to be doing.
I wanted to ask you about another of Trump's picks. The New Yorker magazine's Jane Mayer has an explosive piece in the magazine. Trump's pick for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was forced out of leadership roles at two veterans organizations for misusing funds, sexually harassing women, being repeatedly drunk on the job. According to a whistleblower report, Hegseth once had to be restrained from joining strippers on the stage at a strip club. In another incident, he drunkenly chanted, kill all Muslims at a bar in 2015. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports Hegseth's own mother accused him of mistreating women. In 2018, Penelope Hegseth wrote him an email that read in part, quote, on behalf of all the women, and I know it's many, you've abused in some way, I say get some help and take an honest look at yourself, unquote. The email was sent to year after a woman accused Hegseth of raping her at a California hotel. This is Trump's pick to head the Defense Department. Your final comments on this, Betty Hassan.
So, Amy, if you'd asked me this a few weeks ago, I'd have said Hegseth is the worst pick of all. You can't get worse than Hegseth. And then we got Tulsi Gabbard, and I said, you can't get worse than Gabbard. And then we got RFK Jr., and I said, you can't get worse than RFK Jr. And now we've got Cash Patel, and I'm telling you, can't get worse than Cash Patel. Donald Trump says, hold my beer every time and keeps producing these nominees. And look, while we're focused on Patel, we've got more reporting on Hegseth. I mean, it's astonishing. It's almost beyond belief. If you were writing a TV show about the Trump years, if it was a Netflix show called The Trump Years, you would say these storylines are just too unrealistic. If you were sitting in the writer's room and you said, you know what, let's have a scene where it turns out that Hegseth, the great Christian nationalist, tried to get on stage with strippers. Let's have his mother write him a letter saying, I disown you because of all, you know, your misogyny. You would say, oh, come on, that's a little unrealistic. These are kind of, those are kind of beyond parody characters. No, it's real life. This is the Trump administration. These are the people he's appointing. And I think it's interesting, by the way, the Islamophobia is very worrying on Hegseth's part, because there was this strain of thinking, even on some parts of the left, that, well, Trump won't be as militaristic and belligerent as the Democrats. Not true. He's putting in a guy at Defense Department who has crusader tattoos on his body, who said outrageous things about killing Muslims, supported the Iraq war. He's going to be in charge of the Pentagon. You know, there's no way this is going to be a quote-unquote anti-war presidency if Hegseth's at the Pentagon and Marco Rubio's at the State Department. By the way, can you imagine, Amy, if Biden or Obama had a nominee who had been accused of screaming drunkenly, kill all Jews, it'd be the end of the world. But of course, with Muslims, no one cares, so this will be a minor story in the resume of Peter Hegseth. One last point very quickly is Hegseth's mother is attacking him. Elon Musk's daughter is attacking him. Bill Barr is attacking Cash Patel. Donald Trump was called Adolf Hitler by J.D. Vance. When people say, oh, liberals are deranged about Trump people, it's always other Republicans who are actually leading the charge and reminding us how awful these people are.
And, of course, it's other Republicans who would have to approve these appointees, these nominations, unless this is done in a recess appointment. 20 seconds, maybe.
Many of them will, Amy. They all roll over. They're intimidated by Trump. A lot of them are scared to go against Trump. And it comes down to basically, you know, the four who stopped Gates, Mitch McConnell, Murkowski, Collins, and the new Utah replacement for Mitt Romney, whose name I forget. But those four Republicans are basically the ones everyone's going to look at and say, are you going to stand up for the Constitution? Are you going to stand against this unqualified nominee, Cash Patel, this dangerous nominee, Peter Hegseth, RFK Jr., who kids could die because of? Let's see.
Mehdi Hassan, I want to thank you for being with us, editor-in-chief of the new media website, Zateo. Coming up, we remember Mahmoud Amatoun, the co-founder of the Gaza Soup Kitchen. He was just killed in an Israeli drone strike. We'll speak with his brother back in 20 seconds.
I feel alive in a city that you like. Wait for the day to go dreaming right by. Oh, 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 oh. Seems so hard not to be free.
Pronounce a name.
When you walk right beside.
but Irish post-punk band In the Modern World by the Irish post-punk band Fontaines D.C. The band's guitarist, Carlos O'Connell, condemned Israel and Netanyahu and called for a free Palestine while accepting the award for Best Album during the Rolling Stone UK Awards in London last week. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Gaza. On Saturday, Israel killed more than 200 Palestinians in Gaza, including 40 members of a single family. In recent days, Israel killed three aid workers with World Food Central Kitchen, the head of the intensive care unit at Kamal Adwan Hospital, a staff member with the Save the Children, as well as Mahmoud Amatoun, who co-founded the Gaza Soup Kitchen that's fed Palestinians facing hunger due to Israel's blockade of vital food aid. Amatoun was killed in an Israeli drone strike. He survived by seven children, the youngest just a newborn. We're joined right now in Washington, D.C., by Mahmoud Amatoun's brother, Hani Amatoun. He works as the director of philanthropy at UNRWA USA. He co-founded the Gaza Soup Kitchen with his brother. Thanks so much for being with us, honey. Our deepest condolences on the loss of your brother following the loss of your other brother last year in Gaza. Can you tell us about your brother and what happened this weekend?
Thank you, Amy. My brother Mahmoud was targeted and assassinated in the morning of Saturday. At 9 a.m., he left the house, walked about 30 yards, and a drone was waiting for him and just launched its rocket, killing him on the spot. He was headed to Kamal Adwan Hospital, where for the past 3 or 4 weeks, he's been supporting the hospital with food, delivering food for them, delivering produce from other parts of Gaza, and, you know, even blankets. Everything he had, he gave it to the hospital when he felt the bombs were falling nearby and he could no longer cook for them. He was targeted when the folks who tried to rescue him or they thought they could save his life, they tried to take him to the hospital. Sniper fire fired at them, so they tried again. And they were shot at, so they decided by then it was too late. They wrapped him in a blanket, took him home, said final goodbye, and buried him in a makeshift grave. And this is my brother, the humanitarian, the father of seven, the youngest, who still does not have a name because there is no office in Gaza to give people names or birth certificates. He was debating. The last argument he had was either to name her Aline or Kauthar, and now she will grow without a dad. He is my partner. He is my buddy. He is my young brother who closed every video he've ever sent me. I send this with greetings and appreciation to my friends in the United States of America. Despite the fact that the bombs killed our brother Majid, American bombs, every video he would send, he would say, for my friends in the United States of America. And now he was assassinated and the target was him. There was nobody else. He's a full-time civilian. In fact, we miss him dearly and we're still processing this, but I worry for his seven kids. The oldest one is Omar, was targeted 4 days before the killing of my brother, and he is already receiving medical attention. So you can imagine having to break the news to a kid who's 14 years old, telling him that his dad has been killed and now he is the family provider. It's overwhelming, Amy, and sadly, my brother is no longer here. We continue to pray for him and tell people, you know, we are still there at the Gaza Soup Kitchen. We're not closing shop, not because we want to make a statement, but because we want to make sure our families have food to eat. This is hunger and famine, both in North Gaza and South of Gaza. My brother slowed down the ethnic cleansing of North Gaza, and that's why he was taken out.
You mentioned that at the end of every letter, he would offer a shout out to the people of the United States, despite the fact that they that it was the Israeli military, which is armed by the United States, that killed another of your brothers. Can you explain what happened last year, Hani?
So last Black Friday, about November 24th, an American airplane, I believe it was F-16, dropped a big bomb on our family's house, killing my brother Majid, his wife Safa, his daughters Riman, Suwar, Omar, and Ali, the youngest of him, 7 years old. And it's unfortunate because he's also a shopkeeper. He did not deserve to be killed using American weapons. It took us a week to recover their bodies, and we just observed the solemn or anniversary of their killing by Israel. And now, just a day after that, a couple of days after the anniversary of their killing, we observe the killing of our brother Mahmoud. This was so shocking because Mahmoud has been, he's not a nameless and faceless Palestinian like a lot of our family members are. He's been established a profile. He's written an op-ed to the Washington Post. He was in NBC, talked about the work, and people know him. He is just solves problems. He started a medical point that was saving lives when Kamal Adwan Hospital was sieged and people could not go. His medical point will really provide life-saving care. He started a school. It operated for 2 months, and he put the U.S. flag on the school, and in Hebrew it says, please do not bomb, and it was also bombed. So even Israeli press is asking the army, what happened there? There was nobody inside that school. They still bombed it. And actually, they hit it where it says, do not bomb, next to the American flag. And the sign disappeared because of the explosion. And a few days later, they take out Mahmoud, our brother. And it's sad because this is a policy supported by a progressive president. Unfortunately, this is, you know, I work and I support the amazing work of UNRWA. As you know, they're trying to ban UNRWA. And now they're not only banning UNRWA, the largest humanitarian actor inside Gaza, they're also going after small shops like our family soup kitchen that provided meals for 600 families, found out a way to deliver produce to the hospital. And we believe that's why he was targeted, because Kamal Adwan Hospital, they wanted to have it lifeless and people leave the north. And they, Mahmoud, delayed that because he delivered flour and canned goods and diapers and baby formula. This is no longer about killing any Palestinian who's hurting the Israelis. This became about killing any Palestinian who's helping the Palestinians, like my brother, like the other chefs who were killed in the south. But this is tragic. We're not going to be intimidated. Obviously, we're grieved for our brother. He's a good guy, and, you know, we have to take responsibility for his kids and make sure they're taken care of. But also, we're going to make sure we do this as long as we're able to, because his memory, that's what he wanted us to do. And we continue this legacy. That's why I'm talking to you here. And this is why I want to make sure people know that real families that we know that love this country very dearly are also getting targeted. This is no accident. And they have nothing on my brother, Amy. I feel sorry saying this, but in December, the Israeli army abducts any man in the north. They would release them after 24 hours after they checked the records. Twice the Israelis abducted him, like the hundreds of Palestinians, and they would release him after 24 hours. That tells you they have no interest in him. But they targeted him because of the humanitarian and life-saving work in North Gaza.
I want to ask you further, Henny, about what's happened at Kamal Adwan Hospital. Dr. Ahmed Al-Khalut, the director of the hospital's intensive care unit, was also killed this weekend. If you could comment on what happened to him and the he was killed by an Israeli drone. Your brother, who is known as Sheikh Mahmoud Al-Madhoun, knew him very well. In fact, Dr. Al-Khalut had just asked him to help him find some tomato paste. I want to, before you answer, turn to Dr. Ahmed Al-Khalut speaking to Al Jazeera before he was killed.
The explosions shot shrapnel that can break bones. Israeli forces destroyed the water tanks and sewage system for the 10th time. That's a real problem for the functioning of the hospital. The situation is very dire.
That's Dr. Ahmed Al-Khalut, who was killed this weekend, head of Kamal Adwan's intensive care unit. honey.
Yes, rest in peace, Dr. Ahmed Al-Kahlout. He's a friend of the family. He's our neighbor. He was killed exactly a day before Mahmoud. In fact, he was able to give my brother painkillers because my dad, who's 72 years old, was hurt 2 weeks ago by Israeli quadcopter, and we couldn't find painkillers. The doctor said he didn't want anything. He asked if Mahmoud can do him a favor and get him tomato paste. Can you imagine this hero saving lives and can't find tomato paste? And Mahmoud said, I'll find it for you. And he went to the hospital, and boom, that day the guy was assassinated. He's the head of the intensive care unit. Mahmoud has developed a friendship with Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, the hero doctor, solving problems for him. In fact, 10 days before Mahmoud's assassination, he delivered filtered water for the hospital for the dialysis unit. Can you imagine? A civilian figuring out how to deliver filtered water for the hospital, not just for drinking, but also to run the dialysis unit. You can imagine how important Mahmoud was for the hospital. The hospital already sent their condolences. They're worried about lack of his support. In fact, yesterday, the shipment of produce that Mahmoud ordered just got to the hospital. You know, they are out of fresh food. They're eating pasta and rice that's delivered by UNRWA and the World Health Organization. But yesterday, I was in a conference call with Dr. Hussam, and he said out of the 50 items we need, these organizations are able to deliver 6 or 7. And he's frustrated because he's not getting the help he needs. And, you know, I've met the doctors. They're not seasoned by any measure. They're just fresh out of medical school, trying their best, doing things that even nurses in Gaza are doing operations now because there is nobody else to do these things. And it's unfortunate we continue to do this. And the cruelty, Amy, my brother survived this genocide for 420 days, and then he's killed. And he was telling me the day before, Hani, there might be good news. They're talking about a ceasefire. So one thing to be killed early in the war and not suffer as much. But he was killed toward, I hope, to be the tail end of it. He does not deserve to be killed. And I inquire and I challenge the Israelis to publicly say why they targeted my brother. We have full confidence that he is the person we know. He's a civilian dad who wanted to help his neighbors, and everybody knows him and support him, and we pray for him. But also we want to make sure people there, you know, they can still do things. You know, why are they banning UNRWA? Why is the U.S. defunding the U.N. agency? This is no longer about October 7th and the horrors. This is about ethnically cleansing north of Gaza. The South is also facing starvation. We run a soup kitchen there, and we went from a $1,000 budget to $5,000 daily budget just to get people some rice because food is not available. But we want to respond. Despite our pain, my cousins and nephews and sister-in-law is cooking for people in four out of the 5 soup kitchens we continue to run. We're not going to close because this is our family. This is our commitment. We don't cook for people. We don't eat ourselves. This is not, and this is risky. You know, it should not be risky. It should not be a heroic act to get water to the hospital. And that's why I remember the 230 UNRWA staff who were killed. And not just UNRWA. You've mentioned Save the Children. You've mentioned other organizations who've lost the staff.
World Central Kitchen.
Yes, correct. And unfortunately, that sometimes, you know, Israeli accusations are run in the media as a fact. And that's nobody challenges whatever allegations are made because, okay, it's good enough for me. Nobody's going to push back. And in the case of my brother, we're pushing back as much as we can.
Finally, of course, you are not the only one who's accusing Israel of ethnic cleansing. Israel's former defense minister, Moshe Ya'alon, has accused Israel of ethnic cleansing and committing war crimes in Gaza. He served as Netanyahu's defense minister from 2013 to 16, made the accusation several times over television, including on one of Israel's biggest TV channels. This is what he said, and we're going to end with your comment after this.
To occupy, to annex, to cleanse ethnic cleansing. Look at the northern Gaza Strip and settle a Jewish settlement. That's the point. There is no Beit Lahia. There is no Beit Hanon. They are operating in Jabalia and are essentially clearing the area of Arabs.
That's Israel's former defense minister, Moshe Ya'alon. Your final comments, Haney.
This is our reality. This is the horrors my family faced. We've lost our brother last November. He is a full-time civilian, and they killed our brother. This is the price to pay for standing where we were raised. This is the memory of a Nakba. We learned our lesson from our grandparents who were ethnically cleansed, and now we refuse to do the same. But unfortunately, when they killed so many of our family members, our family relocated, still in North Gaza, standing by, hoping that somebody watching, somebody listening, somebody from our government will definitely develop a conscience and try to save our people. This is no longer a war against terror. This is a war against the civilians in Palestine, including Gaza. Thank you so much.
Hani Ahmad Hoon, again, our deepest condolences. Hani is director of philanthropy at UNRWA USA, co-founder of the Gaza Soup Kitchen, with his brother, Chef Mahmoud Ahmad Hoon. He was killed in an Israeli drone strike in Gaza on Saturday morning. Coming up, we look at the surprise rebel offensive to retake the Syrian city of Aleppo, back in 20 seconds.
We're only made of water, sand, and stone. We're made of joy and make-believe. We're only made of sky, sky, and it's true. If you still believe in joy, even if the world is full of hate, we can blast away.
Joy by Circulatory System. Musician and artist Will Cullen Hart passed away this Friday of natural causes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Syria, opposition forces are pushing towards Hama after launching a surprise offensive to seize most of Aleppo, Syria's second largest city. Syrian and Russian forces have retaliated by launching air attacks on the rebel-held cities of Idlib and Aleppo, a city where rebels were driven out 8 years ago by Bashar al-Assad's forces. The London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports 446 people have been killed in Syria since Wednesday. The offensive is being led by an armed group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which grew out of the Nusra Front, which had ties to al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. The rebel advance into Aleppo is the most significant turn in the Syrian civil war since 2020, when rebel forces were forced to retreat from Idlib. The offensive was launched at a time when the key backers of Assad's government, Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, are also focused on other conflicts. For more, we go to Beirut, where we're joined by Associated Press reporter Karim Shahayeb. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you explain what you understand took place this weekend, Karim?
So it was a surprise offensive that people did not expect at all. This insurgency led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, but there were also other factions and armed groups, including those backed by Turkey. They swept through villages and towns across northwestern Syria, and they made their way into Aleppo. It really appeared early on that they faced virtually no resistance in their, in their insurgency, and they collected, vehicles and munitions left behind by the Syrian army in parts of Idlib province that were under the government's control. Over the past 2 days, we've seen a counterinsurgency from the Syrian government backed by Russia. They've launched airstrikes in the areas where the insurgents are present, whether it's in Aleppo or in Hama, northern Hama province, but also in Idlib, including the city. And this is in the northwest of Syria, is basically the last opposition-held bastion there. It appears also the Syrian government and the army have created like a very strong defensive line in northern Hama. It seems soldiers are trying to sweep into the area to clear forces out. Numbers are still pretty murky as well. The Syrian army said today that their airstrikes alongside Russia killed some 400 insurgents. We're not really sure about numbers of displacement, but there are concerns that it could be thousands, if not tens of thousands of people displaced. We're trying to get clarity from that as soon as we can. And there's a lot of questions surrounding the political implications in Syria. The Iranian foreign minister was in Syria yesterday, met with President Bashar al-Assad, reiterated Iran's full commitment to supporting Syria, as it has through the entirety of this conflict over the past, well over a decade now. And today, upon the Iranian foreign minister's visit to Turkey with his counterpart, it appears they're trying to kick off diplomatic talks, which has been sponsored by Russia, which has, over the years, tried to bring Turkey and Syria back together in terms of, restoring diplomatic ties. So the coming days will be very crucial in terms of what happens on the battlefield and whether there'll be political implications to this surprise attack.
And can you talk about the main group that seems to have distanced itself from al-Qaeda, claims not to be sectarian? What is your understanding of this group?
So Hayat Tahrir al-Sham did grow out of Jabhat al-Nusra, which was the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. And they basically are the most powerful group in the northwest Syria, notably in Idlib province. Over the years, we've seen that their leader, al-Julani, has tried to take on a different image. They've tried to appeal to minority groups. And you can even sort of see this right now in how they're going about areas in Aleppo that are majority Christian or Syrian Kurdish. And they've sort of said that they're not there to harm them and that they are, they're all Syrians and so on. More of a nationalist kind of language in their approach. That being said, there is mixed reporting about how the militants are treating the local residents. So it's still very unclear. We're trying to get confirmation on that. But what we do know is that al-Julani and Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in particular have tried to change public perception about them, particularly from non-Muslim, non-Sunni minorities, notably the Christians, the Kurds, and the Druze in recent years.
I wanted to also ask you about your reporting. I mean, you're talking to us from Beirut. You filed a report Sunday about an Israeli airstrike in southern Lebanon, this despite the ceasefire.
Yes, so the ceasefire went into effect last week, but the next 60 days, the first phase of the ceasefire appears to be very rocky. So during this period of time, Hezbollah is supposed to withdraw its forces from southern Lebanon to the north of the Litani. And the Israeli military has presence and control of dozens of villages and towns in southern Lebanon, and they're still there. And the goal is for both of them to withdraw and to push deployment of the Lebanese army to ultimately become the sole armed presence of southern Lebanon alongside United Nations peacekeepers. That being said, there have been dozens of instances where Israel has struck parts of southern Lebanon and parts north of the Litani. There have been reports of Israeli jets overflights, drone overflights, and this has pretty much frustrated the Lebanese government, the army. Now, it's really unclear what measures they're going to take. Hezbollah has been very quiet on that front since the ceasefire. They've been focusing a lot on commemorating Hassan Nasrallah, their leader, who was killed by an Israeli airstrike back in September, doing some community work and that sort of thing. We do know the army has been very public about these violations, particularly ones that have struck military personnel, and that they say they have complained, and the Lebanese government is doing the same, apparently. This is a really big test for the new monitoring framework for the ceasefire, which is headed by the United States, and is supposed to bring life back into this UN Security Council resolution from back in 2006, which they're trying to have implemented right now. It's really unclear what the Lebanese government's going to do beyond that, whether they're trying to put the trust into the system and hope that Washington asked the Israelis to maybe, to stop these overflights and these attacks. It's really unclear. But over the past few days, these issues are still, continuing. And it has brought some doubt among some people in Lebanon about whether this ceasefire can
Kareem,
hold.
Kareem, we're going to have to leave it
the
there.
Israelis
we hope to do a post-show interview with you. Kareem Shahayeb is the Beirut-based journalist reporting on Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq for the Associated Press. A belated birthday to Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
Hey, Canada, we need to talk. Canadians want a healthy climate, but things keep getting worse. Horrendous wildfires, extreme heat, too much rain, or extended drought. You don't have to face this alone. With Citizens Climate Lobby Canada, you can do a lot. Working together, we can create lasting climate solutions. Visit citizensclimatelobby.ca and step into your power with Citizens Climate Lobby Canada.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.